Joe Jordan, July 25th, 1992, Star Walk.
This is one and the other. Okay, well, with stars, you can do that with the Earth orbit. It's like the left eye is when you're on one side of the sun, and 6 months later you're way over here. So that's what, like looking with your right eye, and you can see the star actually appear to jump back and forth a little bit against the even farther away stars. And if you just figure out how much it jumped and we know how wide our orbit is, you can actually calculate how far away the star is. It's called parallax. Mm-hmm. And then from there you build up even bigger methods of determining even farther away stars.
How long of a walk is this going to be tonight?
An hour, hour and a half. However long you want to be out, half an hour. It's once we get cranking, you might actually find it pretty interesting and sort of forget about the time.
Are you still going to wait for two people here yet?
I guess it's almost time to go. I was just giving a little preview to some folks who can't join us.
Well, thank you.
I think it's right about 10 o'clock now.
Because I was going to just run downstairs.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll
don't
wait
leave
another
it
couple minutes. All right. Yeah.
Is the evening star showing now?
Well, actually, the evening star right now is Jupiter. If you were out of this valley, you can see Jupiter shining down that way, but it's down behind the mountain, I think. And it's only going to be out for the next few weeks in the evening, then it'll be getting...
Tell you what,
that astrophysics.
Elizabeth, would you mind hanging on to this for me?
But the usual evening stars are Venus and Mercury, which can be both evening and morning stars.
I'm going to run and get a jacket.
The orbit they're on, where we are. We're always playing a game of sort of, dancing around the sun, and they peek out one side.
Venus is supposed to be the morning star and Jupiter the evening star?
No, they can all be either.
Either.
All these planets can be up in the morning sky, they can be up in the evening sky.
And they're different stars.
Yeah, they're different planets. The ones that are always only in the morning or evening close to the sun are Venus and Mercury, because they're inside our orbit. The ones outside our orbit, they can be up at midnight. You can see them any time of night. And that's just because they're way out there, and if you just think about the geometry of it, you can see them any time of night. But the ones that are on orbits inside our orbit, they only get so far off to the side of the sun, so they're always up near sunset or sunrise, and that's where the name evening and morning star comes from.
This is the man I never worked with very much.
Yeah, well,
good luck to you, whatever you do,
yeah, well, thanks.
Wherever you go.
Well, we're waiting for a couple people for about two more minutes, I reckon, and then we'll head off. It's going to be a very leisurely hike, more blabbing than walking.
That's what we'd like, though.
Yeah. We're not going to go up to the third level or anything.
Good.
Martin's Ridge, although we would have a great view of it.
Airlift chilling.
Yeah, you get a tram, a star tram. Well, you know what would be neat would be to see an aurora. Northern Lights. Has anybody ever seen them here?
Yeah.
Oh.
Here at home?
Them? At the ballpark. We saw them one night, just a narrow
really?
Band of white.
When? Yeah. When? Recently?
No, like 5 years ago.
Oh, I saw them about a month ago.
Really?
Here?
If it's that white band.
It's just
I
a single
that.
White band. And
yeah.
It expands the tracks, expands the tracks.
I saw them in Spider-Man.
That's up past Cloudy Pass? Huh. What was it? Were they very colorful? Or
they were, no, they're mostly white.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, they...
Sometimes they get kind of purple.
Yeah, might as well talk a little bit about what the Northern Lights are. Of course, there are also Southern Lights, the Aurora Australis. And, basically the aurora is the same thing as a giant fluorescent light in the sky. It's the same process. What's happening is you have these charged particles that are racing in towards the Earth from the sun, protons or nuclei of helium atoms, and they are charged and they tear electrons off of atoms in the molecules of air. And so now you have an ionized oxygen molecule or something, it's missing an electron. And so you got these electrons out there and you have these molecules that don't have all the electrons, and they eventually recombine. And when they recombine, see, it took energy to tear the electron off the molecule, but when that electron rejoins with it, it gives back up that energy in light. So, and that's called fluorescence. And that's what happens in a fluorescent light too. You have a bunch of charged particles that you zap a gas inside that tube with, and it tears electrons off the molecules of gas, but then when they recombine, it fluoresces and gives you light. And so it's like a giant fluorescent light in the atmosphere. And so you get auroras, especially intensely after some kind of solar storm or something with a lot of particles. So usually it takes a couple days that they can detect by light that there's been some big solar storm, but then these particles take a lot longer, they go a lot slower than the light, so they can predict, tomorrow night or night after tomorrow, there's going to be some auroras probably, because the charged particles are finally getting here.
Well, Joe, how about the color? I grew up in northern Idaho, and we saw them really often. It seems like mostly wintertime, but they were beautiful colors.
Red, green, blue. Yeah, the colors depend on which molecules are getting the electrons stripped off of them. You have nitrogen up there, you got oxygen, you got hydrogen, and when the electrons, they have these energy levels, and when they recombine with these molecules, the various different amounts of energy get given off depending on what the structure of the molecule was.
Well,
looks like somebody wanted to run that. Oh, she is back here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't we take a shortcut and go that way? We're heading up that way, so instead of going around the long way, let's just go that way.
Oh, Mark. Saturday night.
Oh, me. Oh.
Okay. Only a couple of them.
Excuse me. I'm trying to sneak up to him.
Mostly new things, but you'll probably hear some things repeated. Let's see, one of the things I probably did talk about before is this blue twilight here, which we'll be rid of probably in the next half hour or so. I mean, it's pretty late here, it's 10:15 almost, and the farther north you go, the longer the twilight lasts, and if you just kept on walking north, eventually you'd actually bring the sun up above the horizon. Right now, somewhere up above the Arctic Circle, the sun's up above the horizon. Down where I come from, Santa Cruz, California, it's already dark by now, I'm sure. And also, a month ago here, we would have had to wait another hour before it got this dark. And this far north, it changes pretty rapidly, the time of the last twilight. And it's also interesting that the twilight swings around, just as the sun and the stars do, as they set. They don't just go straight down in the west or whatever, they go down and around to the northwest. And especially the closer you're looking towards the North Star. And the twilight, actually, you might actually even be able to see a faint trace of twilight, especially at high summer here near the solstice. You could see the blue glow all through the night. And it would move around to the far northwest and then actually across the north horizon and then into the northeast, and then it would get brighter and then the sun would rise far in the northeast. There are actually only 2 days of the year when the sun sets directly in the west and rises directly in the east, and those are on the equinoxes, spring and fall equinox. In the half of the year, the warmer half of the year after the spring equinox, the sun rises by varying degrees to the north of east and sets to the north of west, and it rises farthest around to the north of east on the summer solstice. And then the colder half of the year, it rises and sets to the south of east and west. But what's interesting is that also depends on where you are on the Earth. If you're way far north, then it doesn't even rise or set. It just goes around in a sort of tilted circle and grazes the north horizon, but never actually goes down. Whereas other latitudes, it does go down. But the one place where it's the same all over the Earth, the one day is on these equinoxes, the spring and fall equinox. It rises directly in the east for everybody all over the world and sets directly in the west for everybody all over the world. So it's kind of interesting.
Joe, we're looking at one up here that's moving. Is that probably a satellite or is that
That looks like, let's see. If you got binoculars, you could tell, and I got some binoculars here if you want to take a look. It's probably a satellite, although
it's getting brighter.
Gosh, it's getting really bright there. Look at that. Now that's strange because it's actually moving towards the shadow of the Earth.
Yeah.
So we should see the thing disappear pretty soon. But let's see.
If you're looking through binoculars, all right, let me show it to everybody who doesn't see it. Anybody doesn't see it? What we're talking about is right down there. See that? Can everybody see that beam?
I like your pointer.
Yeah. All right, now I'm going to get these binocs on. If we see a red and green flashing light or something, then can you see this? Hold this case for me.
That was good, Joe.
Yeah, me too.
What happened to our satellite?
It's
over here. It's the shadow of the Earth.
No, it's heading behind. No, that was cool.
I got it in the binocs here. I don't see any flashing lights on it. So that, that's
like a satellite to me.
So that's a pretty high flying satellite, because if it was like only 50 miles up or so, it would have already disappeared into the shadow of the Earth. But that one may be, 300-400 miles up. Hmm. So it's still seeing the sun, way up.
It's got another one. There's the one coming this way now. Look at
them going
to each direction. One's going this way.
Where's the other
one?
No,
it's right above it. See, it's coming this way.
Coming this way.
And the other one's going down.
No, that's a star.
That one's not moving. It just looks like it now.
Relative to that moving satellite, that star looks like
it's disappeared now. It's down. It's down, going down into the pines, and the other one's coming up this way.
Yeah, it is. Okay,
well, let's see here.
Oh, thank you.
Let's see here. Can everybody where you're standing see the Big Dipper over here?
We gotta move the Big Dipper over towards this side of the trail, probably.
Okay. Let's see, here's the old okay. Everybody knows Big Dipper, right? There's the handle and there's the bowl. And those two stars at the end of the bowl. The famous Pointer Sisters, they point towards the North Star, which is up there. And just want to ask you a question. How many full moons side by side do you think you could fit between those two pointer stars at the end of the bowl of the Big Dipper?
Seven.
Well, I mean just the way the full moon looks in the sky.
Two.
Seven, if you put them all side by side, how many could you get in there?
About six. Four.
Five.
Three, four, six. Try 11.
Cool.
Those two stars are separated by 5.5 degrees, and the moon is a half a degree across, as is the sun. And so you could get 11 of them in there. By the way, that's one of the most amazing coincidences of anything, is that the sun and the moon, which are completely different sizes and completely different distances from us, look almost exactly the same size in the sky, and that's what gives us these amazing eclipses. And I tell you, if there's ever any reason for aliens to come and travel to the Earth, it would be to see our eclipses of the sun. I mean, it really is a truly rare thing, probably in the whole galaxy. This kind of situation probably doesn't exist in very many other places. I mean, you'd have eclipses, but the moon would be much bigger than the star for that solar system or whatever. And so we're pretty lucky. However, it's not going to last very long. Well, it will a few more million years, but the moon is slowly creeping away from the Earth by about 4 or 5 inches a year. I mean, its average distance from the Earth is now about 240,000 miles. And it's not known exactly why the moon is getting farther apart. I mean, about half of its recession velocity from us can be explained by the drag of solar wind and other things, and the tidal interaction between the moon and the Earth. The moon is, by its tidal pull on the oceans, it's actually making the oceans slosh around on the Earth, and the Earth is slowing down its rotation very, very slightly. And coupled with this, the moon is getting slightly farther from the Earth. But there's another whole half of its motion away from the Earth, this slow motion, which can't be explained. And the best theory I've heard is that gravity itself may actually be getting weaker. The force of gravity might be slowly getting weaker by about 1 part in 10 billion per year as the universe expands, and that actually may be involved with that. Let's see. Well, we got the North Star up there, okay? Now, the North Star is the tail end of the Little Dipper. Can you see the stars of that handle there, and then the bowl? Those two bright ones, that you always get the North Star, and then you curve back towards wherever the Big Dipper happens to be in the sky. In an hour, that'll be down, or at least the bowl will be down behind Martin's Ridge. And an hour ago, it was up there. Different times of year, in May, you'd see the Big Dipper way over here standing up on the end of its handle. But anyway, wherever the Big Dipper is, you find the North Star using those pointers, and then you curve back towards the Big Dipper to these two bright stars, which are the end stars of the bowl of the Little Dipper, which correspond to the two end stars in the bowl of the Big Dipper. And then there's two other parallel ones that are fainter. See the little rectangle there? That's the box. And then there's this curved handle. Notice the handle's curved the wrong way. It's curved more like a ladle than a dipper handle. But anyway, that's those two constellations. And
isn't it Ursa Major and Ursa Minor? Where's the rest of it there?
Well, I was just getting to that.
Sorry.
Good question. I wasn't sure if anybody really wanted to know. The thing is, you can't see it now because it's down kind of partly down behind the mountain, but it is really an impressive constellation. This is just the tail of a bear. I don't know if bears have tails that long. I think maybe, I don't know if they used to or what, but the bowl is just kind of the rear haunch of the big bear. And then there's a bunch of stars down there behind the mountain, which are the head and the snout and the neck and the foreleg and down to the forepaw of the bear. And then there's another bunch that come down out of the bowl that are the back leg and another little pair, which is the claws of the rear paw. And when you see this whole thing up there, it's really pretty impressive. But most of it's down behind these trees and mountain right now. But as far as the little bear, I don't know of much else of it other than just a little dipper there. It's not a very convincing little bear. let's just talk about this North Star for a moment, okay? That's the one star up there which is going to stay in that position all night tonight. All these other stars are going to be coming up in the east, going down in the west, going around. And if you just aim the camera at that north region of the sky and open up the shutter and let it stay open for an hour, you'd get these streaks, these star trails, that, you know, tracing the motion of all the stars. And they would be big concentric circles all centered on the North Star. And that's because the North Star is directly over the North Pole. If you start walking towards Martin's Ridge right now, and you walk up over the ridge, and you keep on walking and walking and walking, the North Star will slowly get higher and higher and higher. You get up to Alaska, it'll be up about like that. You get way up farther, higher. Finally, you get on the North Pole, it'd be straight overhead. And I was flying over the North Pole on one of these ozone expeditions and sat in the pilot seat for a while, and they had a window just over the cockpit, and you could see the lasers we had mounted on the plane shooting straight up, and they were just appeared to be spearing Polaris right at the zenith, the overhead point. And so you know how when you're a kid, you stand and you look straight up and you spin around like this, and you get the whole sky to appear to be swirling around this one point that's centered in the middle. Well, that's what the North Star is for the Earth. Imagine if you're standing on the North Pole and you're looking straight up. Well, the whole sky is swirling around, but well, we're not right on the North Pole, but we're down off to the side of the Earth, but the whole sky still does that, centered on the North Star. Now, it's really just a coincidence that we've got a North Star. It's just amazing that there's a star that happens to be overhead at the North Pole of the Earth. There's really no reason. That star doesn't care about which orientation the axis of the Earth is. And in fact, we don't have a South Star. You've probably heard of the Southern Cross, but that's actually quite a ways off the South Celestial Pole. And in fact, even the North Star is not going to be a good North Star for much longer. Yeah. The Earth's axis, if you know, the Earth is spinning on its axis, and it's also revolving, going around the Sun in this orbit, like a spinning top. But you know how a spinning top, the axis sometimes wobbles, especially when they slow down? Well, the Earth's axis wobbles on a 26,000-year cycle called precession. Just by luck, right now it happens to be pointing at the North Star, but 10,000 years from now there's a star off in Draco the Dragon that'll be a much better pole star. And most of the time in that 26,000 years there isn't going to be any decent North Star, just as there is now no good South Star. But not only that, so we've got the rotation of the Earth, and then we've got the revolution of around the Sun, and then we've got the precession of the axis, but there are also little 19-year wiggles in the wobble of the Earth's axis, and those are called nutations, and they're partly influenced by the gravity of the moon as it goes around the Earth. And
since it's leaving, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, so what's interesting is that the North Star is actually, Caesar in the play said something about, I am as constant as the Northern Star. What he was referring to was the fact that, it just stays there in one position all night. Now, this was 4,000 years ago? I don't know. So it was, still fairly close to where it is now. But the thing is, it really is a variable star. It's a star which slightly changes its brightness from night to night. There are many stars that do that, and there are two major reasons why stars do that. They can either be pulsating, blowing up and, expanding and contracting and expanding and contracting, and that's what is the case with Polaris, or they can be pairs of stars which just you know, look like a single dot to us, but in a telescope or with spectroscopic techniques, you can tell that there are two of them going around each other. And when they go around each other in our line of sight, they eclipse each other once in a while. So when one star eclipses the other star, that cuts off, you know, half or more of the light from the total system, and that makes the star dim for a while. And I'll show you one of those in a little while. And you can sort of keep your eye on it, you know, from night to night, compare it to the nearby stars, and you can... I actually did a high school science project on the thing. It was pretty fun. What's really interesting about Polaris is, though, it's been varying for the last, they figure, probably millions of years, but just in the last few years, it's been observed to be very rapidly stopping its variation. See, stars will go into a cycle of their evolution where they vary for a few million years, and then quite rapidly they can come to an end to that cycle and then actually become very constant. And Polaris, it was discovered by a lowly graduate student recently, just in the last few years, that Polaris seems to be, just within the last 10 or 20 years, stopping its variation. And it's amazing to catch a star right at that transition point. And as far as why they pulsate, let's talk about that a little bit down the road. We got to walk some more and not get too bored here. It's a long one to do with this. I think about 400 light years.
So the light you see is actually what happened there a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, if the star was gone now, we wouldn't know it for 900 years. Oh, something else I wanted to just show you while we still got a good view of it here is you take the arc. Hey, there was a meteor. You take the arc of the handle of the Big Dipper, you draw an arc to Arcturus, that bright orange star there, and then a spike to Spica. Just keep that in mind for later. Right now, Spica's down behind that mountain, but it's a beautiful, bright blue star. It's the big star, the main star in the constellation Virgo. And so an arc to Arcturus and a spike to Spica, and it's kind of a nice contrast, because what color would you say Arcturus is?
Orange.
Yeah, it's kind of orange, and Spica is quite blue, and which one is thus the hotter star?
Spica.
Yeah, Spica is quite a bit hotter, almost twice as hot on the surface temperature. I mean, red hot, you know, orange and red, they're red hot all right, but blue hot is really hot. And Arcturus is in the constellation Boötes, the herdsman, which isn't much of a constellation, but when you find it, you get one of my little favorite things, another little meteor. You see this over here? You all back there may have to come up a little bit. There's a little smile there. See that? With that bright star in the middle? It looks like a smile with a golden tooth in it. It's actually a Corona Borealis, the northern beer, or that's northern crown, actually. Corona Borealis. Somebody threw a crown up there in the sky, and there it is. And so that's always near Arcturus there. And another thing you might want to notice, tell me how many people can see on this second star in the handle of the Big Dipper, second one from the end, how many can see another faint little star just above it? Yeah, Native Americans used to use that as a test of visual acuity. That second star right there, just above the bright one, there's another faint one. If you look at it in the binoculars, you'll see it. Now, that's not a true double star. By double star, I mean a pair which is gravitationally bound and they're going around each other. But in a telescope, you'll see that the bright star actually does have another companion, which we can't see with our eyes or even binoculars, and that is gravitationally bound to the bright star. Many stars are double or triple stars. In fact, our sun may be relatively unusual in being a single star, although there is a search for a companion star way out there far beyond the orbit of Pluto that, you know, may only come around every few thousand years and is relatively faint and we just haven't spotted it. But it's thought that the sun is a single star, and that's part of where the word solar comes from, or sol, S-O-L, you know, one, sol star. So, okay, let's just walk on a little bit farther here. Okay, hold off with the lights. Forgot to finish off my train of thought there about the business about the eclipses and how unique they are. You know, I was saying we wouldn't have this beautiful situation of the moon just fitting over the sun for, you know, much longer than a few more million years, because the moon's slowly creeping farther away from the Earth. The idea there is that, you know, as it gets farther away, its disk in the sky won't, you know, it'll look smaller and smaller, and it eventually it's going to get to the point where it just can't cover the sun anymore. And right now that happens once in a while. You probably heard about this big eclipse that was last January at sunset off California. Did you all read about that? It was an annular eclipse where, see, the moon actually varies in its distance from the Earth by a few thousand miles, and so you know, when you have the moon far away, it doesn't quite cover the sun. But then there was the real long eclipse last July, about a year ago, down in Baja and out in Hawaii. And that was when the moon was at its closest point in its orbit to the Earth. And so it not only covered the sun, but covered it for quite a while. It was actually bigger than the sun and took it a while to slide across it. So even now you have sometimes when the moon's a little too far away. But what I'm saying is in a few million years, it'll always be too far away at all points of its orbit, and it'll never completely cover the sun anymore. You have to fly up in a rocket or something to get high enough to see an eclipse. Now, that's the moon's variation in distance from the Earth. Here's another neat thing to pull on your friends. The Earth changes its distance from the sun by, well, the average distance is about 93 million miles away from the sun, but we actually are about 3 million miles closer to the sun on January 3rd than we are on July 5th. July 5th usually is the day we are farthest from the sun. January 3rd is when we are closest, by 3 million miles. Now, that's pretty amazing, and you think, well, wait a minute, how come it's hot, you know, when we're farthest from the sun in July, and it's cold when we're closest? Well, one immediate answer is, well, what about the southern hemisphere? There it is cold, you know, it's the opposite season when we are farthest from the sun in July, and there, in January, it's hot down there. So it doesn't have necessarily to do with our distance from the sun. As you know, the seasons are determined by that tilt of our axis, and the fact that in the summertime, the North Pole, the North Hemisphere is tilted towards the sun, so the sun's rays come in more directly. And in the winter, the Northern Hemisphere is tilted away from the sun. The axis stays pointed the same direction. It stays pointed at Polaris all the way around the sun. But on one side of the sun, we're tilted towards it, and on the other side, we're tilted away. So it doesn't have anything to do with the distance. But it's an interesting little fact that we might surprise some people with. I guess we're going to go down across the bridge here and then stop pretty soon. Actually, if you take a look back this way, you can see a W that just came up over the mountain. Everybody see that W? The folks over on the other side of the street might not quite see the two bottom stars yet. Can you see them? If you come back this way, you can see them no problem. Come back towards the bridge. You don't see them, just back up this way. But not too far. It's Cassiopeia. And what it really is, it's a W, but it's actually a queen sitting in her chair in profile. Okay, is there anybody up there who doesn't see all five stars?
I don't see all five
bright stars? Okay, it's that one, that one, that one, that one, and that one.
Oh, okay, it's kind of an
tilted okay.
Oh,
I see. Yeah, it's kind of a, yeah, it's a tilted W, okay? Now, let's see if we can see a queen sitting in her chair in profile. It's like Whistler's mother, but the thing is, she fell over. She's on the back. She's on her back. And those two stars that are right along the top of the ridge, the one on the left is her head, the next one is her butt, and then the middle one's her knees, next one's her feet, and then these bottom two here, or the two on the right, are like the floor. That's the direction of the throne block or something, or her robe, you know, down in front of her. So you can see this lady in a rocking chair that rocked back too far, and she fell over, and she's lying on her back now. So does everybody see that? For what it's worth.
She's on her head in a few hours, right?
Yeah. Okay, now, we're right on the threshold of the steps, so take it easy here. Got some neat stuff to show you here.
I don't see how that can go.
Even those folks who were here before, I got something new here. Look at this cloud up here. Look at that cloud.
No, that's
a cloud of stars.
Milky Way
galaxy. But now, everything you see here is
Milky Way. Yeah.
All these stars are all in the Milky Way. The Milky Way is this great big pancake of stars that we're in. It's 100,000 light years across.
That means
take light, which can go so fast. Yes, like, can I tell you how fast light goes on? Yeah. I could go around the world 8 times in a second, approximately 186,000 miles a second. All right, take light 100,000 years to get across our galaxy. And everything you can see with the naked eye is in our galaxy, except for two things. And really, just one is very easy to see, and that is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's a faint smudge of light that is near the constellation. Well, actually, it's going to be up soon. You see those three stars right there? That one, and that one?
Uh-huh.
Those are three of the four stars in the great square of Pegasus, the horse. And when you take that one there and follow some more stars down in the mountain, probably by the time we're done with this talk, especially when we go over there across near the powerhouse, Andromeda will actually be up. It's tonight will be a nice night to see it. It'll be a faint smudge, and in binoculars you can actually almost sort of make out the spiral structure of it. And all these stars here that we see are, you know, on the order of tens to hundreds of light years away. But when you see this faint smudge that's Andromeda galaxy, you're looking at light that's been on its way to us for 2 million years. It's 2 million light years away. And this stuff in the Milky Way here, I mean, the so-called Milky Way, that's sort of another arm of our own spiral galaxy. And it's also just, you know, that we're in the plane of the galaxy, and as you look elsewhere in that plane, edge on, we're looking edge on along the plane of our galaxy here, and as you look into the plane, all the stars just kind of, you know, shrink into the far misty distance, and that's what this effect here is. And so that cloud, that star cloud, is, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of light years away, out of the 100,000 that is all the way across our galaxy. And now I want to show you this summer triangle, and then a dolphin. Dolphin's everybody's little favorite constellation. These three big stars here are the summer triangle, and they're the three
directly
bright stars
above our head.
Three different constellations. This one here is one of my favorites. It's Lyra, nice little small constellation. It's a HARP. And you see the little parallelogram of stars that are down to the right of Vega there?
Yeah. Right
those
over
are the
our
strings
head.
Of the HARP. And Vega is sort of the crown jewel of the HARP. And now if you see down to the left of Vega, about 8 o'clock there, the little faint star, take a look in my binoculars or any that you brought along at that star. And somebody tell me what you see. Okay, you look. It's the one just
it looks
down,
like it's doubled.
Just down to the left of Vega.
It looks like it's doubled.
Oh, you can see it with your eyes?
Yeah.
Naked eyes?
Oh, good vision.
Wow. Now first find Vega. First find the rough right one in Vega.
Can you see a star?
Well, they all kind of
here, you might take a look. You might have to focus them with the central left. First find Vega, and in the same field of view, you can see this other little star. It's really neat. I'll go ahead and tell you so we don't stand around here getting too bored.
Oh, yeah, wow.
What do you see? What do you see? It's a little pear, right? A little cat's eyes.
Yeah, it is.
All right, now, if you train a telescope on that, each of those two is, again, a double. So it's a double-double star. It's a quadruple star. And there are a lot of systems like that out there. You may have seen the Gemini twins, you know, all winter long, Castor and Pollux. Those are two dots, two bright stars. And the star Castor is a sextuple star. It's a triple-double star. It all just looks like one dot to us, but through spectroscopy and everything, we can tell that it's actually three pairs of stars, with each pair being a pair of stars that are going around each other. Here's another pair over here that's going around each other. The two pairs are going around each other, and then the third pair is going around the other two pairs while they two go around each other. And all that stuff's going on in that one star. And so anyway, here's a nice double-double star. And then, remember I told you about those eclipsing binary stars, the ones that are pairs that are going around each other and they eclipse each other in our line of sight? One of those four stars down to the right of Vega is a double eclipsing binary. You see the two that are along the long top of the parallelogram?
Yeah.
The one on the right, the top right star. If you watch that star from night to night and compare it in brightness to the other ones in that area, you can actually see it going through a 10-day cycle of variation because it's two stars that are going around each other. And now I'll show you the classic example of the other kind of variable star, the pulsating star. And that is in, we just saw the queen, right? There's Cassiopeia, the queen down there. Her husband, the king, is Cephas, and he's just above her there. But it's not a very good king. It's a much better child stick drawing of a house on its side. Here's the square. There's the square, and there's the triangle for the roof. See that?
Okay.
Yeah. Triangle roof and the square. It's a nice house, but it's called Cephas the King. Well, anyway, notice I was a little sloppy with this square here. That corner down there is actually three stars, isn't it? It's not just one. And the three stars are in a little tiny tight triangle, right? Okay, well, one of those stars is a pulsating variable star, and I'll leave it up to you to observe it, and, you know, over, it varies on a 5.5-day cycle, so from night to night you can see it changing its brightness, and I'll leave it up to you to watch it.
Binoculars, anybody?
You know, determine which one's the variable star. It was the first one of these that was really observed and studied in detail, and somebody asked me at the beginning, way back before this thing started, they asked, how do you tell how far away stars are? And that's a good question. And this star, Delta Cephei, Delta meaning the fourth brightest on the average star in the constellation, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, they name them after Greek letters. Doesn't look like the fourth brightest, does it? Looks like it's... But I guess when it gets to the maximum of its cycle, it's actually brighter than these other three stars here. Okay, it is used as a yardstick for determining distances to other galaxies. But before I get to that, let's just say how you determine the distance to the nearest stars. Everybody hold your finger up against the sky, and just one finger up, and you'll see this black silhouette of your finger. Now, close your left eye and look at it just with your right eye, and now switch to the other eye. Close and open with the other eye. Now, back and forth. Do it kind of fast. What happens to your finger?
It moves.
It looks like it jumps back and forth, right? Okay, that's called parallax because, you know, you're looking at it from two different points. Well, you can... Stars do that as the Earth goes around the Sun. You know, 6 months apart, we're on opposite sides of the Sun, and that's like our left eye and our right eye positions to sight other stars with. So we measure the position of this only works for relatively nearby stars against the background of the real far stars, just like you just saw this for your finger against the far background of stars. So for the nearest stars, you can actually see them appear to jump in this 6 month cycle, you know, as we move from one side of the Sun to the other, and you can determine how far they appear to jump, you know, what the angle is, and we know how big our orbit around the Sun is, and just using trigonometry and geometry, you can calculate how far away the star is by parallax. But then, the farther away stars, you've got to start using other tricks, and it was discovered that these pulsating stars here, like Delta Cephei, they have a relationship between the period with which they pulsate and how absolutely big and bright they are. And so, okay, if you know that, if you know from what its period is, how big and bright it really is, and then you know how bright it looks, see, then you can tell how far away it is. Because see, how bright a star looks depends not only on how bright it really is, but also on how far away it is. In fact, let's see. Another little satellite right there. That one looks like a polar satellite to me, polar orbiting, because see, it's moving directly away from the North Star almost. And it's probably a military satellite. A lot of those are polar orbiting. That gives you a much better view of the whole world.
Binoculars?
Yeah.
Let's
see
that satellite. Now, let's
see. Put it around your neck. Oh, yeah, I was going to just get back to the Summer Triangle. Did I talk about the distances to Vega and Deneb yet?
No.
I guess I told this person before. Okay, well, here's an example of the distances to stars, and Vega looks the brightest of these three. Deneb, which means tail of the swan, looks almost as bright, but this one here is 26 light years away. Vega's 20, that means it's 26 year old light that we're seeing. That's impressive enough given how fast light is. It takes 26 years to get here, but this one, Deneb, is 1600 light years away. So that's a factor of 80, 70, I don't know, 60, something like that, times farther away. So which star do you think is the biggest, brightest star of those two? It's obviously Deneb. Even though it looks fainter than Vega, we can tell it's a much bigger, brighter star. Now, let's look at the swan. This is the Northern Cross, kind of appropriate for a hold in here. This is the crossbar, and that's the cross. Mm-hmm. And this star here, if you look at it in a telescope, that's called Albireo, and it's a beautiful gold and blue double star, or orange and blue.
Which one?
The one that's at the bottom of the cross. Yeah, and now it's really a much better swan, though. Here is the head, that foot of the cross is the head of a swan that's flying to the right. There's the long neck, and there's the wings spread in flight. So you can imagine this swan just, you know, on its migration that way. See the long neck and the head and the tail there, and you can even see some little feet trailing back there. So I like that. That's a good constellation. Nice wings and long neck. And so if you look at Albireo in a telescope, it's a beautiful blue and gold double. Okay, and finally, the remaining star in the Summer Triangle down there is Altair in the constellation Aquila, the eagle. And you always can recognize that by the little dim stars that are flanking it. And I guess maybe there's some wings that go off, something like that. And I never can quite get the eagle there. But when you find Altair, you're near the dolphin. Everybody see the little dolphin down here?
Yeah.
It's swimming to the left. It's like a little sideways nine. A little diamond shape there, which is his body, and a little tail over here on the right. So it's leaping out of the water, swimming that way.
Yeah.
See that? That's Delphinus, dolphin. So when you look at the long edge of the Summer Triangle and you go down to Altair, you're almost to the dolphin. So you can always see that. Now, okay, why do we call it the summer triangle?
Well, because you see it in the summertime.
You don't see it in the wintertime. But why is that? Why do we have constellations that change? Here's where I got to do one of my little sun-star dances. So everybody crowd in here in the middle. You all are going to be the sun, which is much easier than the Earth. Here's the sun in size of the Earth. The sun would be like a basketball compared to a TV for the Earth. I'm facing you all, talking to you, and you got a little person on my chest here facing you. So for this person, it's daytime because you've got the sun in the sky. But now when I, you know, as I go around you, I'm spinning around on my tilted axis like this, and going around 365 times a year. As I turn around, this person on my chest is looking out this way now. At nighttime, these are the stars I'm going to see, the ones that are way out here. When I turn back around, I can't see the stars that are behind you. But 6 months later, after I spin and travel around the sun, now I'm way over here. The stars that I you're in the way of them now. Can't see them. They're in my daytime sky along with you. The stars I see now, the ones over here, with that good. So that's, you know, that's what's happening. And in fact, from one night, from every night, yeah, every night the stars come up 4 minutes earlier, and they go down 4 minutes earlier. Now, if you multiply 4 minutes per night times 365 nights a year, what do you think you get? 24 hours, basically. So that means that, you know, at a given time of year, it's always the same time. A year later, it comes back up the same time again. It's 4 minutes earlier than that, and that's because we've crept just a little bit farther around the sun, so we can start to see some more stars a little bit earlier around this side of the sun, a little bit farther, see some more, and so on. But now, that only applies for the stars. You may have noticed that I'm only talking about the ones that are kind of in this ring here. What about the ones up there and the ones down there? Well, those are visible all the time, just like all these up here. They're visible all seasons, and the ones near the South Pole, they're visible all seasons. The ones that are in this band that's in the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun, called the ecliptic, those are the zodiac constellations. They're the ones that are named after animals. That's the zoo, as in zoological. And so those are the ones which the sun gets in the way of. And so when the sun is in Gemini, that means the sun is in the way of Gemini. So, you know, if you're born under the sign of Gemini, that means that you can't see Gemini at that time of year, that month you're born, because the sun's in the way of it. And, well, how do they know the sun's in the way of it? Well, because, you know, they can tell. They can see it until just a few weeks before this time, and then a few weeks later they can start seeing it again in the other, you know, the morning sky, if it was the evening before. And so they can just trace it to where the sun is, you know, which constellations it's in front of at different times of year.
There's so many constellations that we can't ever see them because they're
in the southern. Oh, yeah. Us here in the northern hemisphere, there are many constellations we can never see. The ones that are down there, for instance. We would have to keep on walking up over Furneaux and Copper Peak and way on down and keep on walking until we get upside down, way down in, you know, Argentina or someplace. And, you know, then we'd be down, you know, our heads would be down there and we'd be seeing a whole nother sky full of stars. But the ones that are down under the ground here, in this direction, towards the north, we'll see them a little later. They'll just come up. They'll be rising, you know, a few hours from now. All the ones, you know, around the North Star, anywhere for about 100 degrees of sky on down towards the south, we can see it sometime or other. But on down south of there, we'll never see unless we go down there. And, well, let's see. Oh, back to the Milky Way. Back to the Milky Way. Look how it sort of splits here. See that rift, that great rift in the Milky Way down there? And it gets fatter down there, right? And more intense down in that direction. Well, that's the direction of the center of the galaxy. That's actually getting down towards the constellation Sagittarius, the Archer, and Scorpius, the Scorpion, which are both, unfortunately, down behind these mountains. Actually, a little while later, you might be able to see bits of them, or if we went up farther back than where we came from, I'd be able to see them better. But anyway, you know how the galaxy, you may have seen pictures of galaxies edge on. There are these big pinwheels of stars, and there's a big central bulge. It's like you got this line with a big knot in the middle of it where the central bulge is. That's what we're seeing edge on here. The central bulge is down here. And it really bulges out and gets fat down here, and then it gets thinner here. But what about all this dark stuff? What's that rift? Nebula. Well, that is actually dust. It's dark dust that's in front of these background stars. In other words, this whole area is full of these far, far away stars, but we've got dust that's in the way of it, and then there's nearby stars between us and the dust. So the closest thing are these little dots here, these little stars, and then you got dark dust behind those, and then farther behind there you have the misty glow of the Milky Way, which is being obscured by that dust. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, let's see. All right, let's talk for a minute about, we see any stars that are really twinkling around here? Well, they're not twinkling too much, are they? But I mean, everybody sees stars that twinkle. Canceling each other out, and the whole cake would actually give a fairly stable image. And the same thing with the image of Jupiter. It's like a whole bunch of little dots, which are all twinkling independently, but together they present a pretty stable image. So that's why planets don't twinkle, but stars do. I've never actually tried that. It'd be kind of fun to get a big birthday cake about a mile away, and, you know, with 1,000 candles on, see if it doesn't look like it flickers like a single candle. But anyway, does everybody understand what I was saying there about? Okay. Let's see. Oh, I got to tell you something about scale here. If I forget anything else, I got to tell you one of my favorite things. If we consider how big this Milky Way galaxy is compared to the size of our solar system, if the whole solar system were just inside a ring around your finger, you know, the orbit of Pluto or Neptune is the size of that ring, and then the sun's a little tiny speck, the size of the Milky Way galaxy would be the size of North America. And that's just our galaxy, you know. And then, okay, well, if it's 100,000 light years across, and then I said Andromeda is 2 million light years away, well, that's actually only a factor of 20. I mean, 20 times 100,000 is 2 million. And so actually the spaces between the galaxies compared to the sizes of the galaxies are quite a bit smaller than, you know, the spaces between stars compared to the sizes of the stars. In other words, the galaxies, compared to their sizes, are sort of relatively close together, whereas stars are just, you know, hopelessly far apart. The nearest star, other than the sun is 8 light minutes away from us, and the moon is 1.25 light seconds away. When you see the moon, you're seeing light that, you know, started out from the moon a second and a quarter ago. And it's reflected light, by the way, from the sun. Well, the sun's 8 light minutes away, but the nearest other star is 4 1/3 light years away. That's Alpha Centauri, which, again, we can't see from up here. So I think certain times you can see it down in Texas and Florida. It's the bright star in the constellation Centaur. All right, well, let's see. We've got some more constellations. I want to show you the dragon. Okay? When you find Vega up there, remember that's Vega in the constellation Lyre of the Harp? You come over to these two stars here, which are the eyes of the dragon. And now let's look at the rest of it. Those other two make sort of a snake-like head of the dragon. And that is like the tongue or a flame of fire. And then the body goes down like this and snakes around between the two dippers. See that? You see this serpentine body winding around down there. That's Draco the dragon. And there's the two eyes of Draco. So if you find Vega, you're not far from the two eyes. And yeah,
there's another one going north.
Yeah, another satellite, eh? Yeah. Boy, it's a beautiful night out here. By the way, I gotta tell you, there's gonna be a meteor shower just in a few nights. July 29th is the peak of it's a fairly minor meteor shower. I mean, you might see, I don't know, 15 an hour, 20 an hour. That's not bad. That's, you know, on an average, one every 3 minutes. And see, we've been seeing kind of random ones going every which way tonight, but when you see a meteor shower, the meteors are all seeming to stream away from a certain point in the sky. Like you see one go that way, one go that way, one go that way. They're all seeming to come from that point, and that's the point towards which the Earth is traveling at that time of year. And the meteors are all actually coming in parallel to us. Remember, I don't know if you saw the optics show this morning, the slides. It showed about how parallel lines coming at us appear by perspective to fan out in a sunburst pattern like spokes of a wheel, but they're really all parallel, just like two railroad tracks going off to the horizon appear to diverge, you know, as they get closer to us, but they're really parallel just because of perspective. Well, likewise, if you've ever driven into a snowstorm at night with your high beams on, and you see all the snowflakes coming in at you, and they seem to be fanning out in this spokes of the wheel pattern, again, they're actually all coming parallel straight at you as you drive through them. And so that's what the Earth is doing when we have a meteor shower. It's going through the orbit of an old comet that left a bunch of bits of debris, you know, dust and ice and rock and stuff in its path. And this stuff all comes sparking into the windshield of our atmosphere and making these little trails of vaporizing bits of stuff from comets. And then the best meteor shower of the year is just going to be another week and a half later, August 11th and 12th. But unfortunately, this year, the full moon will coincide with that, so its light will wash out most of the meteors, but you'll still see a fair number of bright ones. And actually, my favorite meteor shower of the year is in December. It's a very reliable shower. From the 9th through the 13th or so of December, you can almost be guaranteed of seeing a meteor every minute right in there some of those nights. Although I heard something about that the orbit of that comet is precessing away, and somehow our orbit of our Earth isn't going to intersect it for too many more years, so that shower may be a thing of the past before too long.
But
that's called the Geminids because they appear to radiate out from the constellation Gemini. The one in August is called the Perseids because it seems to they seem to come from the constellation. Hey, there was one right in Cassiopeia there. All right. Now, we're almost to the point where I can show you Andromeda. In fact, if we just walk a little bit farther up towards the hydro plant, we'll be able to look at Andromeda in the galaxy, in the binoculars. What about the distance between the double stars? They can be almost touching or, you know, on the order of a light year, you know, light years apart. Or like our sun, you know, if they think that it has a companion star that it might be, you know, way out there. They can vary widely. Of course, the farther apart they are, the longer it takes to orbit. Watch out for these things here, okay?
So what's the... Yeah, I don't want to be taking care of them later.
Who's got the binoculars, by the way? Hope take good care of them there. They're good quality binoculars, so drop them.
Joe, how many light years is the farthest star that we can see with the naked eye?
Oh, that's a good question. Huh. Wait till we stop here. Oh, well, yeah, it would be the arc. We're going to come up here so that tree there isn't in your way for stuff off in that direction, okay? All right. If you want to take a look at the Andromeda Galaxy, this is definitely worth pausing for and passing some binoculars around. There you can see the whole great square of Pegasus. Look at that. Those four stars. Big diamond. The bottom one just came up over the mountain there, okay? And the top one is actually kind of a little triangle of stars there again, but anyway, those four. So you grab this one here, and you go down to a faint star, and over to a brighter star that just came up above the mountain. Then you turn up, and you go to another faint star, and then another faint star, and right next to that faint star is a fuzzy little blob. See with the naked eye, right? You see two little things. Does everybody see what I'm talking about? Go down to that star that just rose. It's conveniently right along the mountain ridge. You go up one dim star and another dim star, and right next to that dim star is a fuzzy blob.
On which side?
The fuzzy blob is just above and to the right of the second dim star. And in binoculars, you can actually see a little fuzzy thing that's 2 million light years away. You're seeing light that left, you know, that galaxy, I don't know, back, I guess there weren't dinosaurs then, but maybe humans were just beginning to evolve or something
amazing.
Around
there.
Someone has to find us.
That's the nearest galaxy. We got about 17 galaxies in what's called the local group. Not especially local, but then you have, you know, clusters of galaxies and then clusters of clusters, super clusters. Yeah, just pass it around here and take a look at it. And you can almost detect sort of a spiral, sense of a spiral. But you know, all the wonderful pictures that you see of it, those are long time exposures with you know, fancy photographic plates that, with giant telescopes. So you know, you're not going to see anything like that. You're just going to see a fuzzy blob.
Eight
but
powers, you can see that it's a spiral. Because I've got seven that I'm just getting up.
Oh, there went a nice long meteor. Those there are seven power. And you can see it. I mean, you can. It's sort of almost like it's in your imagination.
Yeah. Okay, then I can see it pretty
well. Hey, look at this. Something's coming up over the mountain. Boy, that star's rising fast.
Okay, right down there.
Somebody check that out with a binocular, see if that's a plane or probably another satellite. There's a lot of junk up there, by the way. There's hundreds of satellites, and some of them have been blown to smithereens by the military and all this kind of stuff. And you know what? A single flake of paint traveling at orbital speeds could tear a hole in a spacesuit for an EVA astronaut, you know, doing extravehicular activity. And some little bit of a satellite or some piece of trash up there moving around in a different orbit from where you are, if it happens to hit your spacecraft, it could tear a hole in the wall of the spacecraft and you'd be dead. So space exploration, because of all this junk up there, is getting increasingly dangerous. And they're trying to keep track of where all the junk is, and it seems to congregate sort of in certain bands. But That's definitely getting to be a problem.
What are the odds of getting hit by a little fleck of something if near a little spaceship?
Well, I guess they're not good enough that they figure they gotta halt all space flights. But let's talk about odds of getting hit by stuff from outer space, okay? It's an exciting topic.
Proposal to spend a lot of money to try to track these meteors.
Oh, is that something that just came up recently?
No, it was about 6 months ago.
Gosh, I hadn't heard that the Bush administration had proposed that.
Well, the Senate was talking about it, too, in a way.
Huh. Well, actually, I think it's a good idea.
What are they going to do, stop them?
Well, yeah, they can. You can do things. Okay, here's the question. There are definitely going to be, I mean, there have been many times in the past, and there will be definitely again, intersections of our orbit and the track of, you know, pieces of asteroids. Some of them quite large. Meteor, you go see Meteor Crater in Arizona. It's about a mile across. Okay, well, so something hit and made a big mile-long hole. Okay, too bad for the things that were under it. Well, it's not that simple. That thing threw up a whole bunch of stuff into the atmosphere when it hit, and it probably darkened a good bit of this country for quite a long time and could have drastically affected the ecology for a long time. And even bigger things, such as the one that hit 60 million years ago, and we now think there have been numerous candidate places where they think it hit, but now they think it's down near the Yucatan in Central America. That thing, you know, killed off the dinosaurs, basically. Not by directly squishing the dinosaurs. I mean, some of them got squished, I guess, but mostly by stuff that got thrown up and darkened the entire global atmosphere for many years and upset the whole food chain. And so the dinosaurs just didn't have enough to eat and they eventually died. This will happen again, or at least it will threaten to happen again. Nobody knows exactly when. Just last year, something passed, you know, half the distance to the moon away from us, by us. It was big enough that it would have made a crater maybe half the size of Meteor Crater. And we didn't discover it until just a month or so before it came by. What were you saying, Barbara?
Now, how are you going to deflect these big meteors?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, the first thought you might have is, well, what an excellent use for all these damn nuclear weapons we've got. However, you got to be real careful. You don't want to blow up one of these things into a whole bunch of little pieces that'll actually be more likely to hit you now. You know, a whole bunch of smaller pieces. Some of the best ideas I heard, things like sending some kind of a rocket up there that can plant itself into the asteroid and then, you know, have a propulsion system that will actually act like a rocket and move that asteroid slightly off course, just enough to miss us. You don't actually want to blow the thing up. You just want to plant a flaming Roman candle into it, basically, that will slightly budge it off its course.
And that would work for something
like
that?
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, you got two tricks. You got to detect the thing in time, and then you've got to do the right thing.
How big are they?
Well, they can be, hundreds of miles across. And something 100 miles across that comes into the Earth's atmosphere at, you know, 30, 40 times the speed of sound can really put a big dent in your plans. So, anyway, it's kind of an exciting thing. I mean, I sort of figure when I imagine what humans are going to be doing or what humans evolve to in the far, far future, I mean, it'll be, you know, healthy things like gardening and taking care of people, taking care of each other, learning, teaching, exploring, celebrating the creation. But they'll also be keeping an eye on the sky. They'll have to. I mean, just for fun, but also sort of as a defense, the new kind of defense against these, space-borne monsters. At some point tonight, if you want, we can talk about the prospects for life elsewhere in the universe. That's actually a really exciting... In fact, why don't I just say something about that right now while we're still passing the binoculars around.
Are they going around?
It actually has a bit of a religious ramification to me. I mean, I'm almost certain that there are other intelligent civilizations out there, and probably many that are millions of years more advanced than we are. I mean, we may not make it through another even 1,000 years, much less a million years. There probably are some who have made it. If we ever could get a message from them or converse with them, it's interesting to imagine what we'd learn from them. Probably lots of neat things about science and technology and stuff, you know, transparent aluminum like in Star Trek IV, etc. But I think one of the most important and significant things we'd learn from them is basically just how to get along with each other, how to persist as a race, and the words that they would use to describe the techniques for that would probably sound a lot like what Jesus said. I mean, you know, Jesus was light years ahead of his time, okay? We're still not used to it, still don't get the idea, but that's what aliens who have made it that long would probably have to tell us as our most important lessons. But now here's an interesting question. Okay, so there are other intelligent civilizations out there. Well, did they have Jesus's? Or, you know, did Jesus come and have a manifestation on all these other worlds? Or was it only on this planet, as you might be led to believe from the Bible? I don't know, the Bible doesn't say anything about other planets, I guess, really, but... Anyway, it's an interesting thing to think about. By the way, speaking of planets, what does the word planet mean?
Wanderers.
Yeah, the planets are the wanderers because, you know, the stars maintain these apparently fixed positions from year to year, century to century. But among them, you know, from night to night almost, or at least week to week, you can notice the motion, the wandering motion of the planets as they're going around in the sun in their orbits. Now, actually, if you run it back 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years or forward, the Big Dipper won't look like the Big Dipper anymore. Those stars are actually moving around too, and they're at all different distances actually. They just happen to look all the same brightness, but they're actually, some of them are twice as close to us as others. They're also different brightnesses. If you could look at the Big Dipper in three dimensions, it wouldn't look like a Dipper at all. It would just look like this thing with all these stars at all different distances. But, you know, over thousands of years, they're going to go off in all different directions, because as all the stars in the Milky Way are swept up in this general, you know, whirling pinwheel motion within the giant pancake of stars that called the galaxy the Milky Way, inside that galaxy the stars are kind of doing their own little random milling around motions. And the Big Dipper stars and Arcturus and all these things, you know, thousands of years from now you won't recognize constellations anymore. But on the scale of a lifetime, they stay the same, or even many lifetimes.
Do you see it?
And the planets wander around and go their merry way amongst them. And
go ahead.
Well, there's all sorts of interesting things to look at with planets. If you train a telescope on the planet Jupiter, which isn't very hard, well, actually, these binoculars, if you look at Jupiter, you can see the four moons of Jupiter. Well, Jupiter has a bunch more moons, but the four brightest ones you can see with this. Although it depends on what night and what hour you look. Sometimes, no, well, Jupiter is now down in the west. Right about 9:30 or 10, we could have seen it maybe if we had jumped way up on Martin Ridge or something. But anyway, some nights you'll see two moons on one side of Jupiter and two on the other. Some nights all four moons will be behind the planet. Some nights a couple of them will be in front of the planet and they'll be obscured against the white of the cloud belts of the planet. And, you know, one will be on one side, three on the other. And these moons will cross in front of each other. They'll cast shadows on each other or on the planet. So you see little black dots on the planet. They'll go into the shadow of the planet. They'll go around behind the planet. And you can see all this stuff happen in a single night. Looking through a telescope, you just wait a few hours and you see all these kinds of things happen. So that's kind of fun. And it was the motion of those Galilean, well, those moons of Jupiter that inspired Galileo to get the idea that maybe, you know, the sun has planets going around it, just like Jupiter has its moons going around it all. And the moons are always in a line when you see them. That's because we are kind of in the same plane that they are all in as they go around like horses around a racetrack. And likewise with the planets. When you look at the planets in the sky, sometimes, right now, we can't see any planets. Although, probably, if you knew exactly where to look, you could see Uranus and Neptune with these binoculars. But sometimes you can see five planets all at once. You can see Mercury, Venus, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars. And when you see them, they're all strung out like pearls on a string. And that's because they're all, you know, horses going around this racetrack around the sun, all in the same plane. And if we are also in that same plane looking at the other horses, they're all going to always be in a line because we're always going to be looking edge on at that plane. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that line that the planets and the moon and the sun all follow is called the ecliptic. And now the moon's a little bit off. It's about 5 degrees inclined. Its orbit's about 5 degrees inclined to the orbit of the solar system. And that's why its motions are kind of more complicated. And you've probably noticed that the moon, you know, doesn't come up at the same time every night, and of course it's different phases. About a week ago it was full. Tonight it probably won't come up till about, well, actually just Saturday night when I was doing the other star walk, beautiful, another beautiful clear warm night, we saw it rise right over that tailing pile there. Very romantic. But it won't come up till about 3 or 4 tonight, and it was almost full that time. Now it's going to be down actually less than it'll be a crescent. So I've already given you a clue to the answer. What I said, the stars rise 4 minutes earlier every night. What does the moon do?
An hour later, right.
About an hour later, 50 minutes on the average later. Although that varies some too. You've probably heard of the harvest moon in October. Well, that's a time when it's rising only about a half hour or even 25 minutes later from one night to the next. For several nights there, right around full moon in October, that means you can just keep on working in the fields from the light of day into the light of full moon for about three or four straight nights, because it's moon's rising almost the same time, you know, and when the moon's full, it rises right at sunset, and it sets right at sunrise. So, you know, you can just go right from daylight into moonlight for several nights in a row. So that's why they call that the harvest moon. There are other times of year, though, when the moon rises more like an hour and 15 minutes later from one night to the next.
Yeah. Something about why the moon looks bigger.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Why does the moon look bigger? It always looks bigger when it's down near the horizon, right? That's called the moon illusion. Okay, this guy's going to tell us. Why is that?
You're seeing Andromeda.
In comparison, so the ground and everything, it looks bigger, but when it's up in the sky, it's small because you don't have it compared to everything else.
Yeah, that's a good... There are all kinds of competing explanations, but I think that's the best one. Definitely. Because, you know, if you see the moon way down there in the gap up there over Bonanza or Cloudy Pass or something, that those mountains are really far away, okay? And if you see something on top of those mountains, you say, well, okay, that's at least as far away as those mountains.
Wow.
And gosh,
isn't that
for
awesome?
It to look as big as it is, it must be huge, you know? But then when you see the moon way up lost in the vastness of the sky... It just looks a lot smaller. But here's an experiment you can do. You can take an aspirin and hold it at arm's length, and you can just cover the moon both when it's down there looking huge on the horizon and when it's way up in the sky. That aspirin at arm's length will just cover the moon in both cases. So that's sort of a proof you can give yourself that it's really just a psychological illusion. It's not any optical thing or anything, although there is an optical effect, and that is with when the moon and the sun get down near the horizon, aside from color changes, you know, they get more orange and reddish sometimes. Also, they get squashed flat. And especially if you've ever had the good fortune to see a full moon rise from an airplane, there you're looking through sort of twice the normal thickness of atmosphere, and the moon just really looks squashed flat into an oval, and it's really pretty uncanny.
Why do they call the Venus the morning star? Is that because it's the last star you can see before dawn?
Okay, well, Venus is actually sometimes a morning star, sometimes an evening star. So is Mercury. And in fact, all the planets can be either morning or evening stars. But Venus and Mercury in particular, they are the two planets whose orbits are inside our orbit, okay? So if you sort of visualize the geometry, they can never stray very far from the sun in the sky. So you're always going to see them, you know, maybe just before morning twilight or at latest just after evening twilight. They never get, you know, you could never see it now up here in the middle of the sky, whereas Jupiter and Mars and all the planets that are out beyond our orbit, you can see them any time of night. But quite often, you know, when we have moved to a position where they're sort of looking like they're close to the sun, they can also be morning or evening stars. And of course, they aren't really stars, they're planets. But Venus is not the morning star. Sometimes it is. It's when it's in the morning sky that's a morning star. But actually, in fact, here's something to watch for in just the next few weeks. Venus is starting an apparition now as an evening star. And that's always my favorite. It's going to be getting so close, so bright now, over until about November or December out here. You come out here on a night like this, you'll be able to see your shadow cast by Venus.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Where will it be?
It'll be over there in the west, over Bonanza Peak. And, down there maybe a little bit more towards Lyman Lake, Cloudy Pass, I guess. Actually, it may well be visible right now in the evenings in the sunset glow. You might have to look with binoculars for a bit, but it has just gone around behind the sun from our viewpoint. See, we're moving and it's moving, okay? And we're playing peekaboo with it around the sun. And now we're moving to where we can get a better and better view of it. And from night to night now, Venus is going to be getting higher and higher and higher in the sky and brighter and brighter. And as it comes up higher, it's also going to be arcing around in its orbit closer and closer to us. Until by November and December, it's going to be very bright. It'll be a beautiful beacon in the fall and winter night skies. It'll be an evening star. And so that'll be something neat to watch for. It'll be much, much brighter than, you know, Arcturus over there or any
beautiful.
Of these other stars.
Anybody binoculars?
Everybody get to see Andromeda?
Yep.
And how far away is that?
Andromeda is 2 million light years away. Well, let's see here. What else do we want to talk about? Well, we could talk about black holes. We could talk about the Big Bang. I tell you what. I got to tell you one thing right now before I completely go hoarse and before everybody drifts off to bed or whatever. This is my favorite thing of all to tell anybody, okay? And I guess only a couple of you have heard it before. But this is the idea that every atom, the atoms in your body, the atoms that we're standing on these rocks, the atoms in the water, in the air, the trees, the mountains, all these things were made in stars. The atoms in your body have at one time been in the hearts of stars. And in fact, a typical atom in your body has probably been recycled through three or four stars in the history of its existence. All right, now, if you think I'm going loony here, let's see if we can figure out how this works. Here's a question for you. Why are you bigger now than you were when you were a baby? Cells divide. Okay, but why? Because what? You ate food. Right. You are what you eat. And it is what it ate. And it was what it ate. And so on. So let's just take the life history of an atom in my arm here, okay? This atom was once in a piece of broccoli. And where was it before it was in the broccoli? Well, that's what everybody says, dirt. And that's what I used to think too. But actually, most likely it was in the air or the water. Plants actually don't take much mass out of the dirt they grow out of. They take trace elements out of there, but they mostly use sunlight to perform photosynthesis on air and water. Those are the main nutrients. So it was probably in dirt or air or water before it was in the broccoli. Where did the dirt and air and water come from? Well, they're all stuff of the crust of the earth, okay? And so now we're at the point of, all right, how did the earth form? Where did the stuff of the earth come from? And that's where we got to understand the idea of a nebula, a giant cloud of dust and gas. You can see a big glowing nebula in the sword of the constellation Orion, the one that has the three stars in a row in its belt. And this cloud of dust and gas about 5 billion years ago, most of which became the sun, 99.99% of its mass collapsed under just the force of gravity to become the sun. And as stuff collapses, it squeezes tighter and tighter together. The pressure goes up. What happens when the pressure goes up? What happens to its temperature? It gets hotter and hotter. And eventually, well, actually, there are stars right now in that nebula in Orion, which on this airplane I flew on at NASA, you could go and observe them. You can see black silhouettes. They're dust clouds that haven't quite started igniting visibly glowing thermonuclear reactions yet, like our sun has. But they are glowing in the infrared, invisible light, which you have to fly in an airplane to see or higher because the atmosphere's water vapor filters out infrared light. But anyway, eventually they start glowing with visible light because they start igniting thermonuclear reactions, which is the same thing that powers hydrogen bombs. The sun is like, you know, a billion hydrogen bombs every second going up on this big ball of fire up there in the sky. And, okay, most of the mass of this pre-solar nebula became the sun, but little side pockets of it here and there became planets. You know, you just got little clumps of it that happened to be a little denser than the rest of it, and they all sucked, you know, once it got a start, it sucked in the rest of the stuff around it. So those became the planets. All right, well, this atom in my arm was once in all that stuff, getting back to the subject, okay? So the question is now, where did that dust and gas come from that proto-solar nebula? Well, that came from other stars that had gone through this whole cycle of being born and then burning away, blazing away for billions or millions of years before that. And then they blew up, threw all their stuff out all over the universe, mixed up with stuff from other stars that blew up. Or maybe they didn't blow up in supernovas, but they just sort of smoked away and eventually became dead crystals, which is essentially what the sun is going to do. The sun's not a big enough star to end in a tremendously powerful supernova. It's just going to kind of just die away and become an ember. But meanwhile, it will have sent a lot of its gas and dust and material out into the universe to interact with stuff from other stars. And so the atoms in your body have been through this cycle of formation, life, and death of stars probably three or four times. I mean, let's face it, the Big Bang, which we think started the universe, produced a lot of energy and light and some matter. And, well, actually, it also produced a lot of antimatter. I got to tell you about that. But first, let's just talk about what kind of elements it produced. The only elements that we know of that came out of the Big Bang were mostly hydrogen and helium. About a quarter of it was helium, maybe. And maybe some lithium, the third lightest element. But all the heavier elements had to be made from hydrogen and helium in nuclear fusion reactions in the hearts of stars. And that's what powers the sun now. The sun is burning hydrogen to create helium by smashing hydrogen atoms together into heliums. The helium atom doesn't quite weigh as much as the hydrogen, and that extra little weight got converted into energy, and that's the energy of the sun. When you say E equals mc squared, that means E is energy, m is mass, c squared is the speed of light, which is a huge number times itself. So you take a tiny little bit of mass, multiply it by this huge number c squared, and you get a huge amount of energy. So all you need to do is have a tiny difference in mass between a helium atom and the two hydrogens that made it, you convert that mass to energy, and you multiply this little tiny m or mass by this huge square of the speed of light, and you get this monstrous amount of energy. So that's what powers the sun. And
so what was I saying here?
Oh yeah, yeah. All the atoms, the calcium in your bones, the phosphorus in your eyes, the iron in your blood, all these atoms, all these heavier than helium atoms had to be made in the hearts of stars. And so that's the most inspiring thing I know of is that, you know, somebody could ask you how old are you, you could say, oh, a few billion years old, and you'd be right. Because the atoms that you're made of are billions of years old. Not the particular combinations into, you know, water molecules or hemoglobin molecules. Those are fairly complex, delicate combinations that only recently were assembled.
Joni Mitchell.
What's that? Yeah. Well, that's right. That's it. That's the story. So, so anyway, that's you know, we were born of fire. We're made of the stuff of the universe. In fact, some of the hydrogens, you know, 90% of the mass of your body is water, and each water molecule has two hydrogen atoms in it. And some of those hydrogens may be straight from the Big Bang. Never even got made into other atoms or anything. Just so that's, you know, you could be as old as the universe itself.
And when was the Big Bang supposedly?
Well, the last time the astronomers voted on the age of the universe, it was about 20 billion years or so, they figure. But it changes every so often. Yeah, I got binoculars.
And so the star that is the most distant that we can see with the naked eye.
Oh, yeah. The star that's the most distant that we can see with the naked eye. Well, it would have to be a pretty bright one, I guess, because it's the most distant. And I don't really know the, you know, exact answer to that, but I would guess that it would probably be some star that is, well, I mean, we know that Deneb is 1,600 light years away, and that's actually pretty bright.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it even looks pretty bright.
Mm-hmm.
So probably there are stars maybe, I don't know, 10, 15,000 light years away that we can see with the naked eye. Of course, you can see Andromeda there with
almost
the naked eye.
Yeah.
That's a whole bunch of stars. I mean, you know, billions and billions of stars, which you can see with the naked eye. So maybe that's the answer there. You just see this collection of stars, Andromeda, and that's definitely the farthest away stars you can see with the naked eye, but that's not a single star, so maybe that's cheating a little bit.
That's okay.
But you know what? In the most advanced telescopes we've got now, they're so powerful that they can look far enough into the universe that in every direction you can look. I mean, see all those holes between the stars now?
Yeah.
In these telescopes, all those holes are filled with galaxies. In any direction you look, the sky is just completely paved with galaxies.
Wow.
So you
like
might wonder,
Andromeda,
what,
you mean?
Yeah, just more and more and more and more and more of those out in all directions.
Wow.
What were you going to say about
all the different kinds of things?
Oh, antimatter. Oh, yeah. This is one of my favorite things. In the Big Bang that started the whole creation. See, all this matter we got here, you think there's a lot of stuff in the universe? Ha. Well, at the Big Bang, there was about a couple billion times as much stuff as this. And, well, you know about matter and antimatter, and if they annihilate, if they hit each other, they mutually annihilate in a burst of energy. Like an electron has a negative charge, well, there's such a thing as an anti-electron or a positive electron, which has the same mass and everything. It's just the same, except it has the opposite charge. It's a positive thing. Likewise, protons have a plus charge, antiprotons have a negative charge. If you smash these together, poof, they both disappear in a burst of gamma ray energy, light energy. Okay, well, at the beginning of the universe, there was about a billion times more matter than what we've got now, and about a billion times of antimatter. Actually, it was a billion and one times more matter. There was about a one part in a billion asymmetry, excess of matter over antimatter. And all that matter annihilated against all that antimatter except for that little bit of leftover matter that didn't have any antimatter to annihilate with. And that's what's left now in the universe. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing that we're just sort of
kind of blows
leftover
you away.
Monster explosion at the beginning of the universe. So,
Is antimatter exists still over the universe?
Yeah, there still is antimatter lurking around. And in fact, it was actually predicted theoretically back in the 30s before it was ever actually discovered in the lab. And you can make antimatter by blasting, you know, protons and other particles, atomic nuclei with high energy particles and things, and all kinds of particles come spiraling out of there. But and some of them are antimatter. And there could be whole regions of the universe still that are antimatter, and they would be kind of walled off from the regions that are matter by these real hot zones where they keep meeting and annihilating each other, you know. But I don't think that that's thought. It's thought now that most everything is matter, and just a little bit of leftover antimatter cruising around. And but anyway, it's a pretty interesting question why there was this initial asymmetry. It's almost that God, you know, just wanted to make things interesting, you know. I mean, if it had been totally symmetric, then all the antimatter would have blasted all the matter, and there'd be nothing. Wouldn't be anything for God to do anything with, or do, you know. So, I don't know, maybe... I mean, that's not a very scientific explanation. They got scientific ideas now for why there was that asymmetry. And they're pretty strange. What's that? Yeah, well, that's kind of what it's all about. I mean, if I want to talk about God, I would figure that God kind of wants to have the universe evolve to a greater and greater awareness of itself, you know? And that's what science is. We're learning more and more about what we are, what it is, and somehow maybe a greater harmony could come out of all that. The more you know about stuff, the more you want to take care of it. You can start with the Earth and with each other, and maybe eventually expand out to the whole cosmos.
Well, yeah. Amen.
Anyway, yeah, amen. I guess I'll hang around here as long as people have more questions, but my voice is starting to go dead.
Odds. You said odds.
Where's Hercules?
Odds? Odds of being hit by stuff. Oh, yeah, thanks. Good night. That's what I think I already talked about the...
odds of life.
Odds of life in the universe. Yeah.
Odds of getting hit by...
Well, I mean, if you just think about how many stars are out there, you know, how many galaxies full of stars. I mean, sure, life took very, very special conditions for life to form, but there's plenty more than enough chances to meet even the most stringent special conditions. And it may not even be all that special either, because we now know that life crops up in the damnedest places. We found it in the bottom of lakes in Antarctica. We found it down in these hot, hot deep sea vents, you know, 500 degrees, and they got life forms that don't even need oxygen. They thrive on sulfur. And so life can crop up in all kinds of places, and so, you know, it could be that life is really the norm rather than the exception on at least a couple planets around stars. You know, they haven't even definitely found any other solar systems yet, although they found stars that are sort of doing these funny kind of wandering motions as they move through the sky, and it's thought that that wandering is because of the gravitational pull of unseen planets that are going around the stars.
You talked about fossils on Mars? I mean, maybe...
Well, you know, there's definitely evidence that there was once water on Mars. I mean, there are old river beds and, you know, lake basins and all kinds of stuff, and where there's water, there's generally life. And so there will probably be in the next couple decades fossil life found on Mars, and in fact there could even be life that is still alive but in a, you know, billions of years worth of suspended animation. Because up in the, some of my colleagues at NASA have been going up to Siberia and digging up out of the tundra there these very ancient bacteria which seem dead, but as soon as you heat them up they come back to life. And they've been suspended in suspended animation for millions of years deep in this tundra. And in Mars you could actually have things that maybe have been suspended for billions of years and could actually be brought back to life. That would be pretty exciting. Even though it's just little germs, it's still something. And
it killed off the whole Martian civilization.
No. Yeah. Well, as I was saying in my talk the other day on the greenhouse effect and the carbon cycle in the Earth's atmosphere, what happened with Mars is that, there was a nice meteor, went right into the Big Dipper. Mars is much smaller than the Earth, and so it's not big enough to really sustain plate tectonics, continental drift. And so the carbon that was once abundant in Mars' atmosphere and made it actually warm enough to have liquid water quite abundant there, there's a cycle where the carbon, you know, goes up out of volcanoes into the atmosphere, but then it rains out of the atmosphere back into the ground, then gets dragged on the, you know, calcium carbonate shells and things in the bottom of the oceans and down into the subduction zones, and then it comes back up in volcanoes. You got this cycle. Well, it turns out Venus lost half of that cycle and Mars lost the other half of the cycle. Only the Earth has them both still. Mars, what happened, all the carbon got locked up in the soil. It all got rained out of the atmosphere, but then there wasn't the plate tectonics to have it come back out of volcanoes. I mean, at one time, when Mars still was hot just from its formation from the solar nebula, there were big volcanoes. The biggest volcano in the solar system is on Mars, Mons Olympus, 15 miles high. But when the volcanoes ground to a halt on Mars, the carbon ended up locked in the soil. Whereas on Venus, it's just the opposite. Venus still has volcanoes pumping carbon out, but there's no more water on Venus. It's too hot, and the water, you know, it couldn't rain it out of the sky, so all the carbon is locked in Venus's atmosphere. And it makes it so hot by the greenhouse effect there. I should have mentioned this in my talk the other day. It's so damn hot on Venus, you could melt lead. It's 900 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the closest thing to hell you could imagine in the solar system.
Isn't the atmosphere itself just so thick, too?
Yeah, it's very thick and very full of carbon dioxide. So it's got a hell of a greenhouse effect.
I mean, the consistency is like water. Like,
what'd you say?
I mean, isn't the consistency of the atmosphere like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, there's some interesting stuff lately about the, you know, the Magellan spacecraft has been finally actually observing the surface of Venus through all those clouds, and they found these very strange things that they think are, you know, meteors that came in, but, you know, it's like throwing a rock into water, and it slows down greatly, and it just kind of slogged through this thick atmosphere and burned up, you know, as it was going, but before it ever made it to the ground, it completely burned up and left, and just left this huge sort of cinder char mark on Venus, and various things like that they're finding. Hey, look, a star just rose over there. Just rose. In fact, if we walk back towards the bridge, we'll make it go down and then come back up again. Huh. Look, in fact, just do it. We just take a few steps. Yeah. We can just watch it close.
Oh.
We just go on the other side of this tree here, we can see it come back up.
Okay.
In about 1 minute, it'll come back up. Watch.
Can we get back to the, looking at the arm of the Milky Way?
Yeah.
And the band is dust. And you said where it's blocked out. It's blocked out by dust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Where it looks like it divides there.
Well, why is there dust there and not dust in other places? I mean,
well, there's dust everywhere, but that's the thickest part of the galaxy, so just the most total stuff is down there. I mean, there's little zones here, too. Like, you see just above Deneb there? Boy, it's nice and dark there. What a magnificent nice. Look at this.
Yeah, it is.
Look just to the left of Deneb. You see that little dark?
Yeah.
It looks like a little dark pipe across there. And also, there's a thing called the Coal Sack Nebula, which is right near Deneb. It's a real dark spot somewhere right around in there. These are all little swirls of dust that are... And you know what? Here's something neat. I always think... You see, this here looks like a bright line, doesn't it? I always almost think that somebody took a cut out of it here and moved it over there. And see, that bright line is because there's actually dust on both sides of that. There's actually more stars all through there, but it's almost all dust in there. Stars just that little bright line.
Yeah. Why is the dust not random? That's what I'm not...
Why is it not random? Well, I guess...
I mean, if we're looking out edgewise out over the galaxy, why isn't it not more regular? Because you said there's
regular.
Dust.
Well, let's see.
Is this in the spiral?
Yeah. Is it because of the arms?
Galaxy? Well, that's actually a decent question, which I guess I never thought about. Let's see here. Let's see. I mean, again, most of the stuff is down there, okay? So that's where the lion's share of all this dust is. And, let's see. Yes, it's kind of random. I mean, like there, you know, half of the Northern Cross has a lot of bright stuff, but over through here is it. Well, heck, I mean,
it's dust from our galaxy.
Yeah, it's dust in our galaxy.
And
well,
is it collecting? I mean, is it...
Yeah, well, there are, you know, clumps of it become nebulae, which become stars, so it is clumpy, but these clumps are actually much bigger than any star that I'm talking about. I guess there are sort of super clumps in the structure of the galaxy. I mean, the galaxy itself is, you know, it's got this overall pinwheel shape, but it is just a bunch of stuff that fell together, you know, after all this swirling from the Big Bang. So yeah, I guess you'd kind of expect it to be kind of clumpy. I mean, this is a relatively small scale of clumpiness.
Right.
I mean, it is clumpy, but compared to the whole size of the galaxy, it's pretty small scale clumps, which, I mean, nothing could be totally uniform. It would be pretty unusual for it to be...
Sure.
Pretty special for it to be totally uniform and perfect, so...
The other question I had, when you're talking about the wobble...
Of the Earth's axis?
Of the Earth's axis. Does that mean that at one time in the Northern Hemisphere, July 25th was... Or what we understand is this point, July 25th was in the middle of winter? Does it switch that much around?
Well, actually, what happens is... That's probably true. That's probably
true. Okay, so, and if that happens every 26,000 years, like you said, Does that change the does that change the seasons in terms of growing things?
Well, actually, you know, it changes a lot in the Earth's climate. There are three main astronomical drivers of the ice age, for instance.
Okay.
There's the cycle of precession, the 26,000 year wobbly axis. And then, you know, right now the axis is tilted 23.5 degrees to the plane of our orbit around the sun. But that number changes between about 21 and 25 degrees.
Okay.
And so that goes on a 42,000 year cycle. And then the ellipticity of our orbit. Remember I said that sometimes we're closer to some than others.
Right.
That orbit actually gets more circular and then even more elliptical than it is now on a 100-some-odd-thousand year cycle. All three of those cycles together modulate the climate of the Earth and cause a lot of changes, which, you know, the ice ages can't be completely explained by these, but in large part they can be correlated to these things.
So it all happens. I guess the things I'm wondering about are like Arctic turns, you know, like the big migration. But it, since it all happens so gradually, it's not a big deal. They just kind of keep doing it.
Yeah, they just keep adapting.
Yeah, and so the trout run, or the salmon run a day earlier every year in the wobble.
So it's not a big
deal. Yeah, so it's not a big deal there.
Yeah. Although a day earlier every year would actually be a lot.
Yeah, but it's such a gradual thing. It never threw off any kind of growing seasons or spawning seasons.
No. Yeah.
Do some more constellations.
Okay.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Who's that, by the way? Anybody I know?
No.
Oh, okay. We'll see you. You weren't playing basketball up there today, were you?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. All right. Yeah, I was too. Okay. Gosh. Let's see. We've done them. Oh, well, Hercules.
Hercules. Yeah,
all right, here's Hercules. It's kind of a faint one, but that little quadrilateral there is the